Hello and welcome to Top of the Ops, a new podcast brought to you by The Drawdown. In each episode, we'll be taking a deep dive into one of our long read articles focused on a top topic in private equity, finance, and operations. My name is John Whittaker. I'm the editor of The Drawdown, and I am thrilled to be joined by The Drawdown's two superstar reporters. Firstly, Sylvia Sicardi, who is here in the room with me.
Hello.
And also, Matthias Plotz, who joins us from Brussels.
Hello.
How are you doing, Matthias? How's Brussels?
Oh, it's absolutely delightful. The sun is out. I think we have around almost 20 degrees, actually. Yeah, nothing to complain about.
Okay, I don't want to hear any more about that. It's still pretty cold in London, so we'll move swiftly on. What are you working on at the moment, Matthias?
I think there's probably two pieces I should highlight. One of them is ESG compliance from the fund of funds perspective. Sort of how do you enforce that across a very diverse portfolio when you invest in funds that will all have different classifications and investment strategies? And how do you ensure that this is then obviously all aligned with sort of your bottom line? And the other one I should mention is my upcoming cover feature, taking a deep dive into credit ratings in the fund finance space, early potential contenders for sort of bigger topics I want to tackle are securitization and the role that rating agencies play sort of vis-a-vis alternative lenders, but also banks, and then what we can look to in terms of potential regulation in the space that will most likely, 99% sure, come eventually.
Yeah, indeed. You'll be hearing a lot more about that topic in Matthias's article later, a later edition of this podcast. Sylvia, what are you working on at the moment?
I'm also working on two interesting topics, one of which is the structuring of deal due diligence costs within the management company. So focusing specifically on aborted deal cost structures. As far as I'm aware, this kind of cost is traditionally charged to the fund because you're outsourcing that due diligence to other providers, but that's not always the case. So I'm kind of looking into the nuances of that structure. Something else I'm working on is based off of a recent report by Citco on the increased risk of waterfall clawback risk is what it's called. I'm kind of looking into why that seems to be happening right now and kind of the different waterfall calculation methods that there are and comparing the two, really. But that's kind of still developing, so we'll kind of see where that goes.
Yeah. As always, these two are working on lots of interesting topics. Meanwhile, I last week was swanning off to the latest IPEM conference in Cannes.
Oh, how was that, by the way?
You can imagine it was pretty good. In spending time on the French Riviera in January is far from a chore, but I thought the event was really good. Strong attendance from LPs and GPs and lots of good discussions. So for anyone who's interested, I've written a short kind of diary piece on my observations from the conference, which you can read now on The Drawdown. The most interesting topics for me were these issues around access to capital in a tight market, not just fundraising, but also being discussed more and more, strategic capital and possible market consolidation. And then also the impact market conditions are having on compensation and incentives, and we're going to be writing a lot more about that in the coming months. One last comment I'd say on IPEM is, if you are going next year, I would highly recommend getting the train down there. So I think the official train experienced some delays on arrival, but leaving Cannes along that beautiful coastline was just wonderful. A very pleasing way to end the event. But I will stop gloating now about my sojourn to the south of France, because we have to turn to the main topic of conversation for today, the reason we have gathered here, and that is to discuss operational utopia.
And what exactly is operational utopia?
Great question, Sylvia. So Operational Utopia was a thought experiment that we conducted for the last issue of the magazine. We asked a selection of GPs, LPs, and service providers to consider the following scenario. If you were to set up a PE firm from scratch with the intention of outsourcing all investment activity, what would that firm look like? And what I really enjoyed about this topic is that everyone I spoke to had a completely different response to it. So there were many people who just dismissed the idea out of hand, right? Seeing investments as the thing that defines a PE firm, and without investment professionals, there is no private equity, right? Whereas others responded by considering the mistakes that they've seen many emerging managers previously make of not prioritizing operations early enough in their development. And then someone like Kevin Muller of Collar Capital had some really interesting insights on how PE firms should spend more time future-proofing from a technology perspective. But as I continued my research, what became clear was there are some in the market who, rather than just dismissing the concept as fantasy, are actually trying to make it happen. So for Will Roxburgh, boutique fund admin firm Kepri, this ops-only model is sort of the ideal, albeit, you know, something he admits he's some way off realizing. And maybe one of the most interesting conversations I had when researching the topic was with Stephen Brannigan of Pantheon Ventures. After we published the article, I caught up with him again to dig into the mechanics of how this model might actually be delivered. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, John. Happy New Year.
Yeah, happy New Year to you too. So, as you know, Stephen, our cover story for January was asking what a PE firm which prioritized operations from the outset looked like. And I think of all the conversations with market participants that I had when researching the article, you were probably the most bullish in terms of this approach being a real possibility rather than just a hypothetical consideration. So, from your perspective, can you explain how you think an operations-only firm could be achievable and what the advantages of that model might be?
Yeah, and my bullishness, I think having had the chance to think about it a little bit further, is probably I've doubled down on that, as I thought about it. I think it's important as well to contextualize some of the aspects. So firstly is, you know, are we talking about a direct PE firm, or are we talking about an allocator like a funds platform? And I think the solutions, but also the question set, is different depending on the use case. But also, we need to think about what's possible versus probable versus realistic or practical. And very, very much in the concept of possibility is where I focused on it. So I think one of the challenges or one of the, you know, exam questions we continually face from a sector perspective is how do you juggle and how do you align either resources, investment, whatever it is, towards between client complexity and investment complexity, both of which are evolving pretty rapidly and have been for the last number of years, if not longer. And I think the big advantage of an operations focused firm is actually you get to focus on one aspect of that, which is the client complexity angle. Investment complexity becomes the, let's call it, the investment manager's responsibility under this model. And actually the client complexity angle, which, you know, has evolved pretty rapidly over particularly the last 5 years, when you think about the different distribution channels available now to private markets firms, PE firms more generally. But also you think about retailization, you think about a lot of all of these almost mega trends happening across private assets, which are driving quite a lot of client complexity. And our challenge as an industry is changing from what was once a very institutionally focused business with institutional client bases to being much more accommodating and recognizing a lot more different client sets. So that's going to be a key challenge that I think this type of model would very much help with. You can be laser focused on client solutions and you become a client solutions provider rather than trying to juggle that investment plus client solutions set of challenges. But really what it does, it offers you an opportunity to provide and put your tech platform at the center of your offering. And that is something, as was alluded to in the article when it came out, is it's typically thought of after the fact, after you close capital, after you start to deploy that capital. It pivots that and changes it and almost spins it completely on its head to say, how do we get information and, you know, self-service data in a position that is the first thing a client sees? And extending that question on, which is really interesting to me, is it opens up a lot of different avenues to say, well, if you have that tech-first approach or platform-first approach, what other pain points can you solve for LPs by doing this? Because that's where you can almost extend and see how you'd extend into an LP's middle office, slightly, and saying, we can take some of that pain away from you because, we have the capability to do it. And that's not something that is traditionally seen or has been seen over the last number of years. So that would be almost the things that jump out at me as one of the main advantages.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of people that I spoke to during my research recognize the clear advantage of that, as you say, being kind of platform or technology first in your focus. But I also had a lot of responses were saying, but the idea in practice is absurd, you know, because you need the investment there, because you need to be earning the fees through investments before you can even start really thinking about building the type of platform, modern platform that you need. So do you think that, although, you know, there are clear advantages to it, the setup costs involved in creating this model would be prohibitively high?
Yeah, so this is where it becomes, how do you turn concept into reality? And that's there's almost that missing link. So I would actually approach it from a slightly different way, which is, what of the client base globally who are investing today in private assets already have existing portfolios? The vast majority, I would say 99%, if not higher. And actually, in this approach, why wouldn't the opportunity be there to just plug into the existing portfolio and actually deleverage the client's headache? I guess for want of a better description. And again, it's to that point of what pain points could you actually solve? So you become almost a portfolio monitoring type capability as much as a new investment. And that might be almost a segue or a transitional state towards getting new investment deployment done and new deals onboarded onto the platform. The costs element is something slightly different as well, which is, I think you'll always have the inherent costs. So compliance, risk, technology costs, people costs, et cetera, regulatory capital costs, all of those are a given. They will be, always there in a regulated industry such as ourselves. But what I think is different now than even 3 years ago, that's the pace at which things are changing, is that there are a lot more technology providers out there now who are pricing and structuring their service offering in a way that means it's not as cost prohibitive as I think it once was. Now, the minefield you have to navigate through is there are lots of service providers selling very, very niche parts of the end-to-end life cycle of a fund, of a product, of a client. So you need to navigate through that. But the biggest challenge we have is, as an industry, is there is no single provider that does everything. And I personally have yet to see anybody. I've seen a couple of firms come close, but there is no single provider of data, of capability, of tech. And that's where I think a lot of most of the cost inefficiency will come. And because you will have a very pressing need to identify what does your technology stack need to look like to be able to service the different things that you'll need to deliver for clients. Given that the role of this business would be very much client service orientated and client solutions focused, you will have to piece that together. And that is going to be a crucial key step. If you have that, it makes it a lot easier, but there needs to be almost an underlying foundational philosophy around how you're going to service both your investment data set and your client investment, your client data set. If you get those two right, a lot of the other ancillary things that you need to do become a lot easier. But the data strategy around those two data sets becomes the really important point. And again, I noted it again in the article, I don't think we're talking about a garage-based startup doing this. I don't think that's feasible. I think the commentary was that, listen, you probably are talking about a couple of years worth of work and a couple of million dollars to set this up. But if I compare that to 5-7 years ago, that was probably $10 million. So the cost of this is dramatically reducing over time. And that's not even to mention some of the Web3 enabled type things that you could consider as well that would reduce that ongoing and upfront costs even further if you take technology advancements to their logical extension and see what else is going on in the wider environment.
Yeah, so it's actually a challenge around expertise and knowledge around the tech rather than the actual costs of it ultimately. Can we talk a little bit around marketing or promotion? Because obviously, in this model, it's going to be dramatically different from your classic founders or partners who have a particular geographic expertise or sectorial expertise who are marketing that to investors. The conversation becomes very different, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the marketing or the promotional messages would absolutely have to be focusing on what the client requirements are. So again, it needs to be you're selling almost a middle office and a tech capability as much as you are an investment thesis or an investment philosophy. I think you can have, and you would have to have, obviously sectoral or geographic or industry based convictions around where you want to deploy capital. But traditionally, we always see a spectrum of clients who, some of whom are dipping their toe into private markets for the first time, who need that guidance and like strategies more so than sectors. So secondaries or primaries or co-investments as an example. At the other end of the spectrum is the highly sophisticated clients who have a very good lens on their sectoral exposures and what they would like. So there need to be an ability to be adaptable to that and plug into that client-led philosophy around their investment thesis. I think this is where it deviates quite dramatically between a fund of funds or an allocation type strategy and a direct strategy. I think it's really hard to envisage and argue that a direct focus strategy is achievable in the near term under this model. I think it's much easier to visualize an allocation based strategy just because of volume of data. But the relationship angle is really something that you just can't you can't outsource. You can't almost obviate the responsibility to think about that, and that is very prominent in the direct strategies. So that becomes really difficult to try and justify, to try and market and see how you could do that better under this model. So I think that would be one of the key challenges. However, where I think the marketing becomes really attractive is if you think about some of those macro trends again, and specifically thinking about the allocation-based model. How do you use data science? How do you use AI to lower your cost of investment decision-making? How do you, use that to inform your future roadmap so that it actually becomes almost not sector agnostic or relationship agnostic, but it becomes very quantitative in nature. So, I know Kevin spoke about this quite a lot. It changes the nature of the type of people you would need to hire from the traditional functionalized operations folks at private market firms. You become much more focused on data, and that becomes the selling point. That's your USP. That is what you sell to clients. And as we spoke about before, it doesn't dilute the need to get the importance of the need of getting those first backers in, but you need to have conviction and almost unequivocal support that this is the right way to go for the purposes of investment selection and investment decision-making over the longer term. Without that, the marketing message becomes really muddled, a little bit more difficult. And ultimately, you know, you are going to be judged based on returns. You know, that's the most objective. It's the most objective things clients will put their fingers on to say, has this worked or not, as a thought experiment or otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned one of the threads from the piece is how you can't outsource some of the relationship side within the PE, or there's skepticism of how much you can do that. But another key thread through it as well is that actually, you know, the investors are ultimately the most important part of private equity, you know, and often managers mistake it and think that it's the investments that they're making, you know, the portfolio companies are really key, but actually, you know, ultimately it's making the investors happy. And I guess, you know, we're talking about a change in relationship between GPs and LPs here under this model. And I sense from, you know, the way that you're talking about it, you think that ultimately it could be an enhanced relationship and ultimately better for investors under this model.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I mentioned the word transparency, you know, quite a lot. And this features quite a lot in how I think about it. It's hard to argue that more transparency around the data that underpins decisions is a bad thing from a client perspective, let alone a lot of the things that they are dealing with, whether it be, you know, risk weighting of assets, regulatory capital considerations, all of which are now becoming much more important, particularly if you're if you have solvency or Basel type requirements to contend with as an LP. So all of that feeds into a set of requirements that they now have as a client base. I think the other side of this coin as well, which is really interesting, is what would need to change from an investment deal team perspective, or a, let's call it an investment manager in this scenario, whereby you're essentially saying, listen, we are non-competitive. We are a capital provider for you to execute on your investment convictions. We are happy to provide that capital, whether it be equity, debt, across the capital structure, or as an LP commitment. And we provide you that access to a pool of capital that otherwise you would have to go and raise and try and distribute yourselves. That's where the really interesting opportunity is on the GP side, which is saying, listen, we're going to provide capital to you. We think you'll need to change your business model, you know, around management fees, carry, et cetera. But equally, we're going to take all of that client-facing, you know, work away from you because we're just providing you with capital. We need data to be able to do that. But ultimately, we're going to let you do what you do best, which is executing deals. And traditionally, you know, what the emergence or the evolution of PE firms has been, you get capital in, you do deals, and then you think about how you service the client, how you use the data, et cetera. You're taking that away from you know, teams who, you know, would arguably just want to consider and focus on doing deals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the can of worms that we're potentially opening there is a question mark about how fees and carried stuff would be structured in that scenario, but we probably don't have enough time to do some guesswork around that. But
yeah, and it's an intentionally provoking a question and discussion in some respects, because it would be pretty disruptive to the economic model that exists today, because essentially, you know, otherwise you run the risk of inserting another layer or an intermediary within the fee structure. And we've seen in the last 10 years, 15 years, you know, fee pressure is only going one way, and it's not up. So yeah, it's definitely a discussion for another day.
Okay, look, Stephen, fascinating talking to you again. I think there's lots of food for thought for everyone there. Just leaves me to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk. Really interesting views there from Stephen. I love this idea that ops-focused approach could potentially disrupt the traditional economic model of PE, which might be why I got so much hostility to the idea during my research. But it is if it's more attractive for LPs, then maybe this is a model that could be attempted by some. What do you think, Matthias?
I think that could definitely be attempted. It reminds me of a recent trip I took to Paris, and I had a really interesting conversation with Philippe Renaud from Sienna Investment Managers. You can read his profile in a drawdown, actually. But he's very passionate about operational excellence and kind of questions the reason behind why firms have operations, which initially came about largely because of regulatory requirements and increasing appetite from LPs for, you know, all forms of reporting. But he's looking into how you could sort of make that a competitive edge, actually. And as he puts it, kind of put the services back into your financial services and distinguish yourself as a GP from your competitors through really excellent customer care that you can operate, that you can leverage operations from. And that actually goes in tandem with another piece I wrote recently, which talks about the regulatory and operational requirements that come with wealth managers as part of your LP base, where essentially due to how the wealth manager industry is structured and operates, they will, for one, need different fund products to be able to invest and allocate into private equity. And on the other hand, for private equity firms, there is kind of a challenge with the operational requirements that come with them. So one big topic is the sheer amount of individual investors you had to onboard. But I think those wealth managers becoming more and more prominent as LPs, as sort of your pension funds and your insurance funds are maxing out their allocations, they signify that next step of operations quite well as an LP base that needs more attention and needs more support to allocate into private equity. But at the same time, GPs who excel at that, they will be better at tapping into that market and at the same time provide better services to their existing LP base, probably.
Yeah, I think this is a topic that isn't going away. This idea of LP-centric service culture is coming up so much in articles that we're writing and people we're speaking to. So perhaps if you're still thinking about operations as just a tick box exercise, you might be a bit behind the curve here. But we would love to hear from you guys, dear listeners, on your thoughts on the topic. Can you see Stephen Branigan's vision becoming a reality, or do you think this whole concept is complete nonsense? Whatever your views, we would love to hear from you. You can contact us via the Drawdown website. There are all of our contact details on there. You can reach out via LinkedIn. You know where to find us. Let us know. Before we sign off, Sylvia, can you give us a bit of a preview on our next cover story that will be the topic of our next podcast too?
Absolutely. I'm so excited. It's going to be released soon, I believe, 2nd of February, if I'm correct. It's all about semi-liquid fund structures. You might know them as evergreen or hybrid funds. But whatever you call them, I'm kind of looking into the increasing trend that we're seeing in the market where funds are either looking to start the strategy or just are interested in understanding how they work from an operational perspective. I specifically focused on the new and improved LTIF 2.0, we like to call it, and compared it to the LTAF in the UK as certain structures that can be used to set up semi-liquid funds. But increasingly, I'm finding that there are some major rules, shall we say, in the LTIF structure that kind of impedes rather than helps fund managers to set up semi-liquid structures. So it goes into that. So if you're interested in hearing from partners Group Eurasio, Neuberg Berman, or Schroeder's Green Crew, you should read the article.
Yeah, as Sylvia says, that'll be appearing online very soon on the Drawdown, and it's an absolute cracker. I would describe it as a labour of love. You'll see what I mean when it goes live. But yeah, very, very much worth your time. Right, so that's all we have for this edition of Top of the Ops, but we'll be back in a few weeks' time. So that just leaves me to say thank you to Sylvia and Matthias for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Absolute pleasure. So thank you to everyone listening. See you soon.